We may not think about the cost to the planet of the music we listen to, as with the clothes we buy or the electronics or myriad other consumer categories maybe. With music, we might assume that streaming, hearing songs on our phones through earbuds, is a lot sleeker and more sustainable, a good deal more virtuous than having a big turntable, amplifier and Cliff Richard's tall speakers in the lounge. Kyle Devine says it's not. In his book Decomposed, he lays out the hidden costs of streaming music. To quote, to stream music is to burn coal, uranium and gas. Professor Kyle Devine is the head of research in the musicology faculty at the University of Oslo. Hello.
Hello.
Decomposed, the political ecology of music. What made you write this?
When I started writing the book, it was because I was continuously coming across these two ideas. This old idea that music is somehow the most immaterial of all the arts. The other idea that I kept coming across was that the history of recorded music could be told as a history of dematerialization. We're used to thinking nowadays in terms of physical formats versus digital formats, yeah?
Yeah.
But digital formats are physical too. If they weren't, then your hard drive would never fill up. And I knew that something wasn't right, because I knew that the digital world is actually a physical world, despite how we're sort of not quite trained, but almost trained to think about it in terms of, you know, wispy clouds and pristine streams and all of these kinds of metaphors.
How do you listen to music, I've got to ask?
That's a really good question. So I am completely a part of this scenario, right?
Right.
So I subscribe to a streaming service. I own LPs, not millions, but some. I own CDs. And as a musician, you know, I've released music on vinyl. I've released music on CD. I have music somewhere up there in the cloud, so to speak. So I'm totally a part of this. I'm not riding in on a high horse here.
Understand. In 2016, streaming and downloading generated nearly 200 million kilograms of greenhouse gas emissions, 40 million more than all music formats in the year 2000. How do we know that?
That question requires some calculations to answer that are maybe not all that much fun for your listeners on a Sunday morning. but essentially, I roughed out the amount of plastics used in 1977 by the recording industry. In 1977 is the peak of vinyl, and then did the same in 1988, which was the peak of the cassette, and then did the same again in the year 2000, which was the peak of CDs. And by the way, these are U.S. Sales figures and U.S. emissions figures only. They're not global figures. It's because when I was doing some of this research with Matt Brennan of the University of Glasgow, we had particularly trustworthy figures from the U.S. recording industry.
Okay.
So anyway, that's a small aside. So I roughed out the amount of plastics used in each of those key years and then looked again at around the year 2015, 2016 and found, of course, that the amount of plastics used by the record industry dropped dramatically.
Yeah.
But I knew that the amount of energy that it takes to run the internet is substantial. And I knew that to run the server farms, as well as the transmission networks, as well as the user end devices and content delivery networks and things, that these used electricity and that these relied on local electricity grids, which means that to stream music from the internet is often to burn things like uranium, coal, and gas. So I converted the plastics emissions roughly to greenhouse gas emissions and then added downloading and streaming in around the years 2015 and 2016 and came up with the idea that the number may well be higher.
We're not environmentally any more holy than we were when we were listening to vinyl and CDs. In fact, we're probably worse. So would that sum it up?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary.
Tell us, if you would, about your visit to the Thai Plastic and Chemicals Public Company in Bangkok, Kyle.
Right. So late in the book, a lot of people, when I was writing this book, which is a kind of material, environmental, and human history of sound recording, a lot of people assumed that it was about this phenomena called the vinyl revival, which is that people are buying and loving vinyl records in ways that they haven't in several years. And so I wanted to find out a little bit more about that. So I went to a record pressing facility in the United States and was looking around, and they were touring me around their factory, showing me how records were made. It was all very interesting and very neat. And records, vinyl records, are made out of polyvinyl chloride. And they have these machines that are often described as waffle iron-like. And they've got these big containers called hoppers on them that are full of these little plastic pellets that are about the size of lentils. And those get funneled into the machines, and they get heated and squished together to make records. And this was all fascinating. And then I wanted to know, okay, well, where do these little plastic pellets come from? And the company wouldn't tell me. I did a little bit of looking around, and it turns out that the pellets probably came from something called the Thai Plastic and Chemicals Company or Corporation Limited. I forget what it is. TPC, though, which is headquartered in Bangkok. So I wanted to know what it was like to make these plastic pellets. And, you know, it took a long time to get through to them. And I eventually got a tentative invitation to tour their facilities in Bangkok. And I jumped literally the next day on a plane. The story turns out that they didn't let me tour the facilities, but I did learn a lot during that trip and in the research surrounding it. This company and its parent company, they actually have a pretty bad environmental track record in Thailand, in around Bangkok, as well as in the south of Thailand, where, you know, workers are exposed to poisonous fumes. Even further up the supply chain, things are even worse in Rayong province of Thailand, where there are reports of poisoned groundwater, as well as even awful things like birth defects. Some of these chemicals are carcinogenic, and polyvinyl chloride in particular, I think both on the production side as well as the disposal and decomposition side, is known as a particularly nasty form of plastic. I mean, one thing about this is that it's pretty much impossible to know music's actual contribution to that picture that I just outlined, right? Music is only a tiny portion of this plastic company's business, right? They at one time supplied as much as 90% of the PVC used in newly pressed US-made records, but even that amount is just a sliver of the overall business that they do. So it's very difficult to know exactly, if we wanted to feel guilty about this, it's very difficult to know exactly how guilty we should feel. I never want people to feel guilty about the ways that they choose to listen to music when they find out about this. I hope that knowing about this might lead to other forms of action and things. The friends of mine that I have that are most likely to, say, drive an electric car or buy organic food, you know, are also those who seem to really prize the warmth and naturalness of a vinyl record, yeah. Which is an interesting contradiction because this is, of course, you know, an oil-based petrochemical product.
Well, we're all capable of blind eyes and hypocrisies in our lives, aren't we? But speaking of other forms of action, there are some Dutch companies making vinyl greener, but it doesn't sound as good.
Right. What they're calling greener forms of records or greener LPs. The consortium I'm thinking of says that their records are made of a non-PVC material. So I assume that it is still an oil-based plastic, but they are doing really interesting and innovative things, and they're doing it, you know, out of a love for music and out of care for the environment. I did listen to the record, and I did feel the record, and I touched it and everything, and it didn't feel like the kinds of vinyl record that I was used to, and it didn't sound like the kinds of vinyl records that I was used to, but that didn't really bother me. And even if it sounded slightly different to what I was used to, I thought that was probably something I was willing to trade off if they are doing good with their material and their new production process.
The New Yorker magazine says your findings may provoke a helpless sort of shrug. Now, I know you don't have a clear, large blueprint for what we should do, but, you know, I mean, have you changed your behavior at all? For example, I mean, we should do something, I guess, is the point of what you've researched.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. A helpless sort of shrug sometimes. throwing one's arms up in the air and saying, you know, are you kidding me? First, I have to worry about the kind of car I drive or what kind of fuel it uses. And then I have to worry about, you know, sorting my trash. And now I have to worry about what kind of light bulbs I have. And now you're telling me I have to think about music, too.
As you say, it's the wispy clouds and it's the pristine streams. I mean, you point you make is that music is a special category that somehow transcends the conditions of its production. But that is a bit like saying that fossil fuels are fine so long as they sponsor all the ballet and opera companies. It is a bit like that.
Right. So, I mean, I think that there's a strong and you know, historically and culturally very strong way of thinking about music that wants to detach it from a lot of its realities in this world. And really one of the things I'm trying to do is just reattach it to those realities. Not even reattach it, just point out that it has never been detached from a lot of those realities.
In fact, you say that mass market music reproduction has been dubious going right back to Thomas Edison, don't you?
Yes, music has always been involved in extracting resources from the environment as well as labor from people. And it's true, going back to Edison and his cylinders, as well as what sort of followed that period, which is the shellac 78 RPM disc period in that history. And if you don't know what a shellac 78 is, it's, I mean, you may have felt one in an antique store. They're sort of heavy and boxy and a bit brittle.
Yeah.
And they're actually made from a resin that is derived from a beetle, and most of that resin came from India at the time. You know, this is a natural product. It's a renewable resource. It's a biodegradable material, and there would have been a lower carbon footprint from that. But at the same time, the people that worked to harvest and process this material in India were treated very badly in colonial India at the time. They were paid very low wages. Women were, of course, paid much less than men. There was a law against employing children as workers, but that law was disregarded. The factories were dangerous and dirty, even though the carbon emissions would have been lower, even though this material, shellac, this bug resin, seems very green. It's also connected to this sort of side of human investment and human labor that is really, I mean, it's a bit difficult to stomach, to be honest. And I think it's really necessary to think of environmental issues, not just as a numbers game of carbon, but as you know, a really human, cultural, social story as well.
Mm. So CDs, once decried as, you know, despicably digital and without any soul, are in fact the best things you can listen to if you really care about planet Earth that much.
Well, there was a study published in the Conversation by two UK researchers who suggested that, I think the number was 27. If you were going to listen to an album more than 27 times in the time of your life, from a carbon perspective, it was better to buy that album on CD than it was to stream it constantly.
Okay. That's quite a calculation. Which,
it was interesting.
Yeah. You've got a chapter on the cloud, getting back to the wispy clouds and the pristine streams. And you're right. I mean, to us who don't think overly much about it, most of us, it does seem ethereal and disconnected from the surly bonds of Earth. But in fact, the cloud is nothing like that, is it?
No, it's not. And yeah, the wispiness of the cloud, the flow of the stream and all of these things are, I think, in many ways deliberately designed to sell that sort of invisible image of the cloud, and to make it seem almost magical. In reality, it is a global network of cables and cooling systems and satellites and all of these things. All of these things do require substantial amounts of electricity. And that electricity, as I mentioned, is generated from local grids, which means, yes, it could be hydro, but it could be coal, it could be gas, it could be nuclear. Those are, you know, very physical and sometimes very dirty realities. And that's what the internet is. I think, you know, of course, satellites factor into this. But for many people, in many cases, the only part of the internet that is not part of that hardwired system is the distance between, you know, whatever router you're nearby and your computer.
Spotify issues sustainability reports. It says its environmental impact is decreasing. it's on the, quote, carbon neutral, unquote, Google platform. Google itself is transitioning to solar. You have your doubts about all of this, though, all these protestations.
These are not bad moves, right?
Mm.
But one thing I noticed in the Spotify reports is that they showed that their, you know, energy use had decreased. But, you know, in the last few years, what's happened is that a lot of companies that previously ran their own data centers have decommissioned those and subcontracted that work to huge data center operations like Google. But I think Google has committed to going zero carbon as soon as it can, which is no bad thing.
Do we have too much music now? When I was growing up, there was the radio. You'd listen to music at the record store if it had turntables, and you'd buy the albums you wanted. There was not the infinite choice that stretches out in front of us today. And it's the same with Netflix and the video streaming sites. I mean, the range on offer is immense. And is that good, or do we completely not need all of it?
Well, it's probably not for me to say whether it's good or whether we need all of it. But what I would, when I think about this issue, I think of, I reflect on the idea that music is actually only a microcosm of some really widespread and deeply seated ideas in especially industrialized, wealthy countries in the world. And these sort of ideas have welded our notion of better to the desire for more. The way that streaming services work, they depend on a form of individual subscription consumption, and they depend on the fact that that consumption is repetitive and endless in a sense. That endless cultural consumption and economic consumption is also an endless energy consumption. And so somebody I was talking about this research recently made a really interesting connection. He said maybe the way, and even going back to records, the way that we've developed a relationship to recorded music is similar to car culture, where it's, you know, one car per person or one or two cars per family. And he said, maybe what we could go back to is something more like a public transit model of music. And he said, maybe radio is actually a kind of public transit model that from an energy perspective could be beneficial.
Now you're talking, Kyle. Good to talk to you. Well, of course, we'll all just keep streaming, won't we? But you know that.
Yeah, and you know, another important thing to say about this is that in the grand scheme of things, you know, music is a really small issue.
Sure.
Compared to the amount that we stream video, the amount that we stream all kinds of other things on the internet. Music is a very small portion of that.
And it's always a trade-off, isn't it? I mean, it's given a lot of artists breaks they would never have had and introduced them to global audiences they wouldn't have been able to be introduced to in the past. All that good is going on as well.
Sure, those stories exist, definitely.
Mm. Interesting research, though, and an interesting book and an engrossing sort of thesis. Thank you very much for your time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor Kyle Devine, Head of Research in the Musicology Faculty at the University of Oslo, and his book, Decomposed.